Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk about 2013 and Broadway, the year in review. Please stay tuned.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair. Where are the clouds? Isn't it?
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, December 29th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchaland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Welcome to the end of the year. This is the last time in 2013 we get to do our little show.
Mm-hmm.
So with us also is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
As I alluded to, this is the last time in 2013 that we can say we're in 2013 and talking about what's happening in and around the Broadway arena. So we thought that maybe we would talk about what's 2013 been to Broadway. And let me shoot over to Peter. And Peter, tell me, you know, what did you think about 2013?
Not bad at all. I certainly enjoyed seeing A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. I thought it was wonderfully directed. I certainly like the book by Robert L. Friedman and the lyrics by Steve Lutvak. The music was pretty good too, though I have to admit the best music I heard this year was in Wichita when I saw Betty Blue Eyes out there. Musically stood out for me more than many others. In terms of plays, certainly the two Shakespeare revivals that Mark Rylance starred in were tremendous. I loved his new interpretation on Richard III. I also very much admired Joseph Timms playing Lady Anne in that production as well. But Mark Rylance really went out on a limb and didn't fall off it by playing this almost a prankster. I mean, we saw a sense of humor in Richard, which we hadn't seen before. So that was pretty impressive. And he was quite wonderful in Twelfth Night, too, playing the role of a woman who didn't dare love because she was highborn. Paul Chahidi, I think his name is, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, was terrific, too, as Mariah in that. So that was really quite wonderful, beautifully directed by Tim Carroll. So those were highlights. But as usual, it wasn't just a case of Broadway scoring. So many of the most wonderful things I saw were off Broadway or in the regions. The best actor I saw in a musical was Jeff Blumenkrantz in Murder for Two. That's off Broadway. The best actress, because he played a million parts, and I'm exaggerating only slightly by saying a million. The best actress in the musical I saw was Clea Blackhurst in Hello, Dolly! Out of Goodspeed, and the best featured actor was Tony Sheldon, who brought something very new to Vandergelde, being somebody who was really desirable, not just somebody who she'd marry for money. So I thought that was great. The best featured actress in the musical that I saw was Alexandra Socha in Fun Home, playing the middle of the three ages we saw our lesbian heroine do. And I'm sorry to say she's left the show. So if you didn't see her already, you've missed her, which is really too bad because I thought she was just terrific beyond belief. So I liked her immeasurably. The best play I saw was off Broadway. That was Bad Jews by Donald Margulies and Tracy Chimo, an actress who I admire to the nth degree, who always plays these terribly awful human beings, and that's not at all what she's like in real life, I have to point out. So she's amazing in this play, playing a relative who is now dealing with a legacy of a death and has to deal with that and has her own opinions, while her brothers have very different opinions. I think the best featured actress I saw was Ann Scoria out in Providence, Rhode Island, in The Grapes of Wrath, playing Ma Jode. Phenomenal performance. And if we're talking about one-person shows, I'd go with Ruben Santiago Hudson in How I Learned What I Learned, playing August Wilson, in essence. So I think the best comedy I saw was called Fix Me Jesus by Helen Sneed. Also, the woman in it, Leroy Rogers, was really terrific in it. And this was about growing up in Dallas in the 60s and having parents who were just concerned with superficialities and not caring about a girl's mental prowess, you know, going to college to get a husband and not an education. So I also liked Jacqueline Wright and Patron Saint of Sea Monsters quite a bit. So I thought it was a good year, and I certainly hope that the second half of the season will certainly bring even more bountiful gifts to us. We'll see if that's what's in the cards, but nevertheless, so far so good.
Well, that's quite a list to talk about just that you listed in the last 5 minutes. Wow. All right. So I'll remind everybody that no, I'm kidding. So, Michael, what did you think about 2013 so far?
Well, I of course, I agree that there were many good things off Broadway and beyond Broadway and in the regions. I don't get out of town as much as Peter does, but I did see several wonderful things, one of which I'm so thrilled came into town, which was the ART production of The Glass Menagerie, which is so incredibly beautiful. But, you know, it's amazing. I may have mentioned that Mimi McMahon is her name, who played Laura when I directed the show 30 years ago on Staten Island. She told me she was going, and I guess she just went because I saw her Facebook post this morning, and she said how she, you know, it was one of the most beautiful things she's ever seen in her life. And she was sitting there at the end of the show in tears after the curtain call, and the guy in front of her got up and said to his date, "Well, that was the most depressing and boring thing I've ever seen in my life." Mm. So I'm not sure what my point is in telling this, except that people have their own responses, you know, based on a million variables, you know, as to what their own lives are and what they've been exposed to artistically. And it's, you just really never know. But and on that show also, it's been interesting to me how there have been some very strong opinions in both directions on Cherry Jones's performance. I thought she was beyond wonderful, but some people seem to think she's too strong for the role. They seem to have this idea of Amanda as this very fragile person, and I guess I disagree with that, and I, you know, I'm not sure how they can understand that in some ways she's a very strong person. But but it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, even when you see something like that, which you would think this is so magnificent, you know, this is, you know, you shrink from saying definitive, but you almost want to say that because that's how beautiful and brilliant it is. And then other people have a completely different opinion. It's fascinating. Something that's in the news now and will be, I guess, maybe more in the next few days is the film version of August Osage County, which I got to see.
Oh,
and that's
you.
Getting some very, very mixed to negative reviews. By the way, Jeff Blumenkrantz was at the screening I went to, Peter.
Uh-huh.
I'll be curious to hear what people think about that, because it's getting a very, very different response overall than the show did. It seems to be the fact maybe that it's an hour shorter seems to make some people feel that has exposed its flaws or whatever, or that the very fact that it's shorter makes it more more blunt, you know, like a little more kind of surfacey and even campy. So I don't know. I'll be interested to hear what everyone says. Because
did you like it?
I did very much like it. Although I liked the play very much, I never thought it was this incredibly deep, profound work. I don't know if it was intended to be, but you know, when something wins a Pulitzer, I guess maybe some of us attach that meaning to it. There's nothing terribly new in it. To me, it's just very well written and provides amazing opportunities for really good actors, and they have some incredible people in the movie. You know, Meryl Streep, Margot Martindale seems to be getting raves from everyone, even from people who don't necessarily like the movie overall. Chris Cooper is magnificent in it. He's really, really wonderful in a different type of role for him, I would say. It'll be interesting to see the reaction of the general public as it gets out more, because I think it's one of those situations where it just opened very, very limited screenings in some of the big cities to make it eligible for Academy Award consideration, this coming year. And it's not going to get a wide release till after the first of the year, I believe. So it'll be interesting to hear what people say about that.
What's missing, Michael? What's
well, you know, I have to say, I mean, my first reaction was that it was an improvement. I just felt that while I enjoyed the play very much, I felt that it was overlong, and I didn't notice anything, offhand that was like, oh boy, I really missed that. One thing is when it's a film as opposed to a show, there's an argument that you can cut more because you can get more from the actors in terms of close-ups and things like that. And that can sort of fill in gaps where maybe you sometimes need more time on stage to make a particular point. I really liked it. And actually, I was taken aback by some of the negative reviews. So there you have it.
Well, my point is, was part of the plot dropped? I mean, for example, like the incest thing. I'm just giving one example. Did they drop one thing? Or, for example, my last book, I was supposed to have 90,000 words. I had 125,000 the first time I checked. And I said, this is what I got. They said, you've got to cut back. And so I cut out every adverb. I mean, you know, is this what they did? They cut out a little line here and there?
I don't think any major chunk was dropped. And certainly, certainly not that thing you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And so, but for example, there was that, there's that bit where there's a intimation of that an older man has a very unhealthy relation, interest in a very young woman. That was still there. Some people said that they felt maybe that it wasn't stressed as much as it was in the play, but it certainly made the point. I mean, there were people around me like going, and cringing, so I guess it made the point. And Dermot Mulroney, by the way, is very good in that role. So it's quite a cast, and it'd really be interesting to see how it does ultimately. Also at the screening I attended was Michael Urie, whom I wanted to mention as an example of a person who's in another very, very big off-Broadway success, Buyer and Seller, which I never liked that title and I still don't like it, but the show is pretty great, and that has been a great success. I hate to think, though, that what's necessary to have an off-Broadway success now is for it to be a one-character play. Yeah. I love one-character plays when they're done well, but I'd like to think that one can afford more. But Bad Jews is another excellent example. So thank you for that one, Peter. I don't know if that will ever get to Broadway, and I don't know that it needs to. I'm sure it's going to be done lots and lots.
Yeah. Sure. How many guys out there want to imitate Barbra Streisand? I mean, really, yeah, it's going to be done a lot. Yeah, so I see your point.
Just want to say also, in general, I think on Broadway, I am a little afraid that there continues to be, generally speaking, and of course with many exceptions, this movement towards more mindless entertainment and also things that people already know, as in these bio musicals and songbook reviews. Nothing wrong with them, but you know, when they become the preponderance, I think that's a very frightening thing. And when something like Big Fish flops so badly, even though it's really quite good overall, despite its flaws, you know, I mean, I'm not sure if it flopped because people think they didn't like it or because they didn't go to it in the first place because the tickets are so expensive that they would rather spend their money on something that they are pretty much guaranteed they're going to like because they know, you know, they know it really well, whether they know the music or it's a star that they really want to see or whatever. I think that is a very frightening thing, and I'm not sure that there it's reversible.
Well, one of the nice things, of course, about the holiday season is you get to go to a lot of parties, and of course you get into a lot of discussions with a lot of people. And Big Fish came up a great deal at the parties I attended, and it was so interesting to me that so many people made the same observation. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily saying I agree with it or it's important, but nevertheless, I was hearing all the time, you know, I expected those flights into fancy to be really spectacular because Susan Stroman was doing them, and they weren't. And more to the point, I became much more interested in the family story than I expected to be. And I guess that's a good thing, but I was disappointed that the two elements didn't mesh very well. So that's what I was hearing more than anything else. But there was a lot of sadness accompanying these criticisms.
Right.
Big Fish really deserved much more of a run than it got. And it's really too bad. Also, what's too bad, it's always sad when a theater star who is not a Hollywood star isn't enough to carry a show with the public, that they do need somebody who they've seen in the movies. Because Norbert Leo Butz, certainly, you know, already two Tonys, is one of our stars, but he's not a famous person outside of New York. Similarly speaking, Jefferson Mays, people are wondering why Gentleman's Guide isn't doing better. And Jefferson Mays is a wonderful performer. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that. But at best, he's a Broadway star, and the general public doesn't know who he is. And it's sad when that happens, that the fact we hate to face that our stars are not stars across the board, that outside of this 13.7-mile island of Manhattan, that not very many people know them. So yeah, it that's part too, and I wish it weren't.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I literally hate to say it, but as excellent and delightful and fabulous as it is, I'm not terribly surprised to hear that Gentleman's Guide is not doing better, because it's kind of the perfect storm. None of the people in it are major stars to the general public outside of Manhattan or New York area, as you said, nor is the property, that well known. And even if people do know Kind Hearts and Coronets, it's not called that. So I don't know if people even make that connection. Despite all the good things that we see, that general movement towards, I'm only going to see something that I know to begin with, or the only time I'll see something maybe that I don't know is if it has a major star in it. I think that's very, very, very unfortunate and frightening. And I do not know how it would be reversible, except if ticket prices suddenly became cut in half. And I don't think that's going to happen.
No.
So we go up against this all the time where people talk about stars and shows versus no stars and shows and well-known properties and new things. And then we have things
Book
like
Book of Mormon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Book of Mormon, the stars are the
you
South
bet
Park
the writers.
Guys.
You bet. You bet. That's you know, exactly right. It does have stars.
They came in with a built-in audience that were ready to buy X number of tickets to start it off and get the wildfire going. But I think about Rent. And maybe you guys could fill in some of the pieces here, because I don't really remember the 1996 season insofar as what else was playing. But certainly this season, we have a lot of quote-unquote stars on Broadway, and we have a lot of well-known pieces, all the Shakespeare pieces and the revivals and things like that. So I think that A Gentleman's Guide is, if it were not up against such a strong competition, might have caught fire. I mean, what do you think about that? And what I'm trying to look up the 96 season to see what Rent was up against. What do you
know? Big, certainly swinging on a star, Bringing the Noise, that was the main competition that year, as I recall. The star of Rent was Jonathan Larson, though.
That's true.
So, and that's what happened there. But, you know, it's such a conundrum because, you know, you get a star, and the star only commits for a certain amount of time. Back in the 50s and 60s, you could sign a star for a year, and in a year you'd pay off. And so if you brought, I'll go with Rosalind Russell in Wonderful Town, and then Carol Channing came in. She didn't do business. They closed it, but they had made money because they could pay off in a year. Now you can't pay off in a year, and the point is, once you have a star opening a show, if you don't get a star to succeed that star, then the show seems like damaged goods and people don't want to see it as much as they did as they would when the star had left. So that's a problem too. You know, you just cannot get a star to commit to a run of the play contract. Judge Lee Andrews almost had a run of the play contract with Phantom of the Opera. I mean, metaphorically speaking, because he was with it for so many years. But the fact remains that you're not going to get any star to have a run the play contract with musicals today, because musicals are expected to run 5-10 years, and it's just problematic. So they're not going to commit to that. They most of them just want to commit to, you know, 3 months and win their Tony and go home and say they won a Tony. So
it's, you know, tangent to our discussion here, I tripped over a recording yesterday, the day before, of Frank Sinatra singing Sendin' the Clowns. And I'm interested to see, Peter, was there ever a point where Frank Sinatra toyed with coming to Broadway, or anybody? I'm sure everybody tried to woo him to Broadway, but there's the famous story about trying to do the Carousel movie with Frank Sinatra, and he sort of begged off of that. He didn't enjoy the process.
What comes to mind, in 1965, when he turned 50, there was a lot of tributes to Frank Sinatra. He did an article for Life magazine in which he said, I've done everything I've wanted to do in show business. The only thing I haven't done is a Broadway show in which I had no interest whatsoever. So I remember that quotation from 1965, whether or not indeed he was. I never heard him mentioned for anything that anybody went after him seriously. But I will tell you this, the biggest mistake that Frank Sinatra Jr. made in his life was not going for a Broadway career, because that's the one thing his daddy didn't do. And I think he might have found a home here.
Well, you know, that's interesting. I never thought.
Instead of playing, you know, Holiday Inn lounges, and I mean that, he actually did. Bob Green in Esquire wrote an article once about him playing, if not a Holiday Inn or a Ramada, but you get the point.
Yeah.
You know, so if he had done that, he would have been very wise. We might have welcomed him with open arms, figuring this is the best Sinatra we can get.
I also never heard of Frank Sr. Being in any kind of serious discussion for Broadway, but I do remember that there was very serious discussion about him doing the film version of La Cage aux Folles.
I agree. Yes, yeah. I remember that too. That would have really been something.
Yes.
Because if there was one thing that Frank Sinatra always wanted to be, it was butch. You know, that was a very important value of his, and for him to play a homosexual, even the butcher of the two homosexuals, would have really been something. And we all raised an eyebrow when that was being talked about. And what's really too bad, of course, is that the movie was never made.
Right.
Of course, you know, it took Chicago forever to be filmed, and and The Bohemian Girl too, if we're going to get technical. but nevertheless, you know, who knows, if we all long enough, maybe we will see a La Cage aux Folles movie, which would be fine with me.
So get back to the recording that I listened to.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, it is, isn't it? It is, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, really, we all have our preferences, but to me, the only worthwhile recordings by Sinatra are the Capitol recordings when he was recording for them. I mean, the Columbia, his voice is very nice, but it's very different, but it didn't have the crisp bite that it did in the Capitol years. So
that's I felt he was totally disconnected from the text and didn't, he was like wallowing in the,
yes,
the lush sound of his own voice rather than in singing the song. And I was shocked about it because it's the first time I ever noticed that about Frank Sinatra.
Well, you know, I've always said that the, you know, that the best recording of Sending the Clowns is Judy Collins. And I think it's because the song is so, you have to be very careful with that song because it can so easily tip over into self-pity and wallowing, as you said, James. And so I think to sing it just very simply, because I think all of the meaning is in the words and the music without putting a lot of emotion on top of that. That's one reason why Glynis Johns' version is also so wonderful, you know, despite whatever vocal limitations she may have.
Which is one of the reasons why the song was written in the first place.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Well, of course, the Send in the Clowns recording isn't much good because, of course, he was losing his voice at that point. I mean, late in the career, he did two albums, at least two that I know of, duets where he sang with other people, even though they weren't in the room with him, but they were duets. And all I could think of at the time when these came out, this reminds me of like when you hear about an old person who can't go out anymore, you have to have somebody go out with him, you know, and that's what it seemed like to me, that the other people were really carrying him more than that it was a genuine duet. So.
But I want to leap in here. Earlier in his career, Frank Sinatra had done many wonderful recordings of Broadway songs. There's one entire album called something like The Broadway Sinatra. But one of my favorites, and I may have mentioned this before, you have got to get this album if you like Frank Sinatra and you like Broadway and you don't have it. It's called The Concert Sinatra, early 60s, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's a very interesting combination of most of it is Richard Rodgers, either Rodgers and Hart or Rodgers and Hammerstein. It opens with I Have Dreamed. It's got Bewitched. It's got the soliloquy from Carousel.
Full soliloquy, even those lyrics that are often dropped are in there.
I think so. It's got I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought now.
Well, let me jump in and mention that he did so many recordings, even in the reprise years. He did Golden Moment from the musical Hot September, which never came to Broadway. But I remember driving up to Massachusetts to see Bajor, I'm serious, at a community theater. And it was happened to be the weekend that he had died. And so, therefore, it was really fascinating to be driving to Massachusetts. And no matter when a radio station faded out, there'd always be a new radio station to connect into that was playing Sinatra. And I was amazed. I had no idea he recorded Cherry Pie's Ought to Be You from Out of This World, a Cole Porter song. I was amazed. I had no idea. I mean, you know, so while he didn't really care very much about performing on stage, he certainly was interested in songs that came from Broadway. And, some of those were favors. I mean, he loved Kahn and Van Usen because they had given him so many wonderful songs like High Hopes and All the Way. And so as a result, when they did Skyscraper, he recorded Everybody Has the Right to Be Wrong, and I'll Only Miss Her When I Think of Her. Though it is interesting to me that, to my knowledge, the next show, Walking Happy, I don't know that he recorded anything from that. I've never heard anything from that. So maybe he felt that that's where he drew the line. But a lot of Broadway songs, indeed, and they make for very good listening.
Well, interestingly enough, he was famously known for not wanting to do more than one take when he was filming a movie. I guess he felt that he could not maintain spontaneity, repeating something over and over. So I think you have to, you know, give him credit for recognizing that that's just not something he was good at or wanted to do. And very similar to Streisand, right? Many, many stories about how she would start walking through in Funny Girl and you know, and even maybe like you know, screwing around a little bit because she just was bored with saying the same lines night after night, eight times a week, you know, for wasn't it 2 years?
No, it was a year, I think.
Okay. Well, I don't remember, but even if it's 1 year, you know, it's just, and other people, you know, they thrive on that. They think nothing of
it. It was 2 years. You're right. It was 2 years. Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Go on.
I mean, that's just a specific talent that some people have and some people don't. And I guess, you know, that, you know, people are, a lot of people are very resentful and upset at Streisand for not doing a Broadway show after Funny Girl. But, you know, I think there's a lot, you know, you can look at it in the positive way and say, well, she knew that that was not for her. And the same thing with Sinatra. He just, you know, if he had done a show, he probably would have gotten bored and he might have ended up like Zero Mostel, you know, just kind of messing around on stage and, you know, and breaking other people up and ad-libbing. I mean, who knows?
The DNA disease.
Yeah. Yeah.
By the way, I don't mourn his not doing Carousel at all. I think
McRae
is fine. I think he would have been very strangely wrong for it. So that might have been a blessing in disguise. What I would have liked to have seen happen, you may have heard about this, that there was going to be an animated Finian's Rainbow, and he was going to provide the voice for somebody. I don't know which character. Maybe Woody.
Woody, yeah.
And
actually, those tracks exist. Did we discuss this, Peter?
I don't think so, but
there's a multi-disc collection called Sinatra in Hollywood, and it's got that on it. And he sings because Ella Logan, was going to do the voice of Sharon, and so they do Old Devil Moon, and Ella Fitzgerald was going to sing Necessity.
Mm.
That's on it. It's really kind of amazing.
So. A few things that we went by and I want to come back to is that Bette Midler's show, Sue Mangers, is out in L.A. And Barbara Streisand went to go see it the other day. Mm-hmm. Yes. And it was very interesting to see how much the media was interested in what Barbara Streisand thought of that show. But the show is living off, has an afterlife after Broadway. And I wonder if it's been so well received in Los Angeles, if it's going to have yet a touring life after that. What did you think? Is this something that it's just really specific to New York and L.A.? It could live, or could it live on afterwards?
Sure, I see no reason why it can't live on. I'll tell you what amused me most was Streisand's reaction, where she said, "And I quote, some of the facts are not true."
Yeah.
Well, the word facts, you know, all right, need I go on, you know. But it was a very enjoyable evening, she said. So, you know, but some of the facts are not true. Okay.
Yeah. But I think, but James, at the risk of stating the obvious, that if the reason it won't go on is because I don't think Bette Midler will do it forever and ever. And I don't know, I can't imagine anyone else taking it on. But I'm glad you mentioned Streisand, because I wanted to say props to her for her wonderful contribution to the Marvin Hamlisch documentary, which aired on American Masters just a couple of days ago, What He Did for Love, which had a lot of great talking heads in it, including Peter Felicia. But Streisand, you know, she is so wonderful, and she obviously gave her time, and they had several clips of her talking very fondly about Hamlisch. And interestingly enough, all they got of Woody Allen was some garbled phone call, apparently, that was all he felt necessary to give.
Right.
Yeah, I you know, I mean, that, come on. I don't know.
So What He Did for Love video is available online, and I'll link to it in the show notes, because it's really, if you did not see it, one of the three of us appeared in it.
Yes.
the thing is, though, that you really came away with the feeling that Marvin Hamlisch was quite a nice man. And I'm very happy to see that. He was always lovely to me, I have to say. But the joy of composing and the joy of performing really came through. And you don't get that from everybody who composes. And it was just wonderful to see his sparkling personality and come through. But most of it because he was doing good work and he knew it. I'll tell you one thing I said that they didn't put on the broadcast. And I'm not saying they should. I'm just saying this is something I said because I want to go to bat for this now. And it's going to sound like hyperbole, and I don't expect anybody even to believe it. And maybe that's why they didn't put it on, because they didn't believe it either. But there is really no Marvin Hamlisch song that I dislike. I really like every song that I've ever heard of his. Some I like, of course, better than others. But there's never been one. I'm even including the Gene Seberg show where I said, oh, God, that stinks. That's not true of every composer. So he really, his music really intrigued me and spoke to me, and I enjoyed it immeasurably.
Yes, and on a similar note, I would say, and I've said before, that I think he always elevated the project, even when some of his collaborators were maybe not quite at his level. So that even when there is a song that maybe the lyrics are not that great, somehow the music always is. You have a very good point, Peter.
I'll tell you another thing that they dropped, which I wasn't surprised at all. Barbara Tablish and I did a luncheon at the Friars Club where I popped the questions and he gave the answers. But anyway, at one point, you reminded me because you were talking about collaborators who weren't worthy of him. And of course, one of them was Carol Bayer-Sager. And I mentioned her, and of course they had been romantically linked, and it's one of the reasons we have their playing our song. The story greatly reflects their relationship, and by that point in time, this was in the early 2000s, Marvin had greatly soured on Carol Bayer-Sager, and he was trying to indicate how difficult she was to work with because she was and I said, free spirit. To which he said, she wasn't free at all, she was very expensive, you know. because Carol Bayer-Sager appeared on this documentary, I think that's one reason why they didn't use that story that I because I did tell that. So I guess not. But that really happened at the Friars Club some years ago.
Well, a few of the things I would like to talk about this morning is Hugh Jackman is leaving Houdini, or has left Houdini,
left,
I should say. How did they know? Did anybody see him leave?
Well, the article I read did not have a lot of information on exactly what state the project is in terms of how much of it has been written. But I think, was it that article or somewhere else I read that there was some kind of a reading of the score or a somewhere? Did either of you read that?
No. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying.
Yeah. But that's what I mean. There was no specifics on that. So when I read that he left it, I was at first very surprised because, first of all, we hadn't heard about it in quite some time. And also, I wasn't sure what, you know, what it consists of at this point. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
I was sitting next to Steve Schwartz at a show in fact, it was Children of Eden. MTI was doing the junior version of the show, and he was there, and we happened to be sitting next to each other, and I asked him about it. That was July. He said, oh, no, it's very much on. Yes, we're doing it. You know, so at least as of July, I know it was a viable project. So, but who knows?
Hmm. Well,
that's a real setback, though.
Yeah,
really.
You know,
is.
It's interesting to see if it, you know, as we find out more and more about what happened there, if Houdini was really on track and Hugh left, or if it was off track and Hugh said, I need to move on to other things. So we'll find out about that. But something that's coming, that's being talked a lot on the West Coast, I don't know if it's coming in or not. I hope that it's coming in, is a revival of Sideshow, where they're
at
the La Jolla Playhouse. And it seems that they have...
I guess you would say a revisal of...
Yeah, reworked it to be From what I'm reading, I haven't seen it. From what I'm reading, they're saying that it's more of a historical look at the sisters rather than the love story. But I'm interested to see if they're able to bring that back in.
Yeah, there's a lot of good in Sideshow, but I do think that the love story is problematic. You really cannot expect any human being to say yes to a Siamese twin situation. I mean, I know people have, and all right, fine, but you cannot make an audience identify with a character who says, yes, I will be wed to one of two Siamese twins. And it's just too crazy. So I always felt Sideshow would have worked if at the end, if after he turned her down, her saying, look, I understand entirely. You've done so much for me. You've taken me out of the Sideshow. Yes, let's be friends forever. I don't think there would have been a dry eye in the house. So if they're going in a different direction, I'm all for it, because I love the score of Sideshow, and I certainly love the performances in it, and I like the production too. I knew they were in trouble because it was done on the cheap. It was the best they can do to get it where they got it. So I know people who pay Broadway prices expect to have their eyes knocked out, and that didn't happen with a couple of bleachers and Sideshow. But as a work itself, there was a lot of good in it. And I'm interested as well, James. I'd love to see Sideshow again.
Well, as far as the love story, I mean, I don't recall. I imagine at the time I read all about it, but I certainly don't remember. Was that supposed to be how factual, to quote Barbara Streisand, was that supposed to be?
I don't know. I really don't.
And also, does that matter? I mean, suppose.
Oh, no. I'm not saying it matters. I'm not saying that at all. Okay.
No, yeah, but that's my question. Like, suppose for a minute that is all factual, and that, you know, there was this actual person, you know, who wanted to actually marry one of them. Does that mean that we put it on stage anyway, even if we think that audiences will go, what? You know, it's an interesting question.
I believe that the sisters that are featured in Sideshow actually did get married and have children.
I'm looking at the moment.
So. Yeah, I seem to recall that. But my point is, does that mean the authors can just say, but this is what happened, you know? And does that make it any more palatable to an audience because it factually happened, or does it not matter at all if it really happened?
Yeah. No, yeah. And I think that Peter said exactly what I've been trying to articulate for so many years. And I love Sideshow. I've done a number of productions of Sideshow. I paid to see it on Broadway a number of times. I really enjoyed it, and I love the score. But there was something missing, and I think Peter said it exactly, is that the audience needs to be have to identify with that character that is willing to marry a Siamese twin. And I don't think that we ever got there in any of the shows.
Well, and interestingly enough, I my biggest problem with the show was none of that. And I think I mentioned before, my biggest problem was that it seemed to me that the style of the score was really all over the place, and that they had a couple of numbers, I suppose, that were supposed to be their actual vaudeville numbers that sounded period, but then there were other numbers that sounded like they were, you know, they could have been from Dreamgirls. And I understand that doesn't bother some people, but I guess it bothered me primarily because there were some songs that really did sound like that they were period. So I'll be interested to see if that issue is addressed in this new version.
It does say here they had numerous affairs, failed attempts to get a marriage license, and a couple of short marriages. So, I understand that. I understand that there are people who will do this. I just don't think you convince the average person that this is a terrific way to live your life. I mean, especially it says here, Daisy died first. Violet died between 2 and 4 days later. Well, whether you married the one who died first or died second, I mean, that's really spooky. You know, I mean, so you just can't expect anybody to be convinced. You know, it's one thing, you know, when white audiences went to Raisin in the Sun in 1959, when they walked in the theater, they didn't want black people living next door to them. And when they came out of the show, they thought, well, this wouldn't be so bad. But you can't expect people who walk into the theater saying, I would never marry a Siamese twin, to come out saying, yes, I would. It's just too much. It just is.
Well, I guess maybe the argument is that they don't. I mean, this is something that they very much want, and you know that they dream of, but as much as they want it, they can't have it. And as proven by what you said, you know, just reading these biographical facts, that very short marriages. I mean, it's kind of heartbreaking, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So
oh,
maybe,
yeah.
So maybe that, I mean, it's not as if the musical presents it that one of them did marry someone and they had a happy marriage. Mm. I mean, that might be a little much for anyone to swallow. Yeah.
Sure.
So something else that was in the news this week was Wall Street Journal wrote this piece called The Babes of Broadway. And it talked about the number of children that go to Broadway shows, and it's been an increasing market, which I think is wonderful. Is it because of Cinderella and Annie and all the other things, or the Disney influence on Broadway, or you know, it's a very encouraging thing to see young kids going. Now, on the flip side of it, you know, we're taking my wife and kids to go see Annie before it closes next week, and that's a, you know, that's a $700 evening.
Yeah, I'm afraid it is, isn't it? Yeah.
On a related note, I'd like to ask Peter about his experience, because didn't you see A Christmas Story this week, Peter?
Oh, that's right. I wanted to ask you about that at the Garden.
Anybody who's ever sat next to me in a theater knows that I laugh about once every four shows. I've seen it all, you know, I mean,
I didn't know that about you.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
I bet I laughed 75 times at Christmas Story. I just had the greatest time. I mean, granted, I had wonderful seats in a house that offers plenty of bad seats. But the production itself really was quite wonderful. I think it's a terrific musical. I think the book is excellent. I think the score is excellent. The performances are excellent. And I'm sorry I'm saying this on the day the show is closing, but as you may recall, I had a play of my own that took up a lot of my time earlier this month. Which, by the way, went very well, and I'm telling you, plenty of people were in tears at the end of the show, so there. Anyway, Christmas Story, really so wonderful, and if this is what has to happen, that they bring it to this place every year, all right, so be it. But the audience really had a wonderful time, though I will say this, there was a lot of consternation, you know, there has been, about that Asian waiter coming in at the end of the show and singing Deck the Halls, you know, and fa ra 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 ra, you know, that type of thing. For better or worse, whatever it says about America, whatever it says about the audience that's going to Christmas Story, not only did that get the biggest laugh in the show, the people applauded after it happened. So make of that what you will. I'm only reporting what happened.
That's such a big part of the movie.
Yeah, I know.
Well, so. Apparently there, you know, I mean, there's several things going on there. I mean, I think it is funny when people, maybe it shouldn't be, but it's funny when people, when we hear people who are not native English speakers doing something that's very, you know, that's very, very American and doing it in an accent. So and that's probably true for foreign people as well, I would think, you know, maybe the French laugh at Americans. But then there's the other apparent issue that I have to confess I did not know, that some people are saying that only Japanese people switch the R's and the L's and not Chinese. So that just makes it more of a stereotype. But my suggestion was, that I think it would have been equally funny if they just if these Chinese people came out and sang a popular Christmas carol in Chinese. Don't you think that would have been hilarious?
Yeah, certainly. That type of thing usually does work. I mean, people
early modern Millie.
Yeah, and for that matter, it happens in MASH too. You hear the film of MASH anyway. That you hear pop songs done in a different language. Sure, you know, it's something to think that people would risk that type of thing. As I said, they definitely got away with it in my performance. It was appreciated. But given that there's been so much criticism, why open yourself up to that criticism when there are alternatives?
Yeah,
so,
I mean, I wonder if they thought of what I said, which is, as you say, is not a new idea. And it worked wonderfully in Thoroughly Modern Millie.
Sure.
So who knows?
Sure. Yeah, because there is something inherently funny because you don't expect people of right. that background to know those songs and know them word for word, you know. So that's the joke of it, you know. That's what makes it funny. But anyway.
So back to the Wall Street Journal article that we're talking about a few minutes ago. I just wanted to bring in this one statistic from the article. It said, in 1980, 400,000 children under 18 attended a Broadway show. By last year, that number had nearly tripled, growing to 1.12 million, according to data compiled by the Broadway League, the industry's trade association. So 1.2 million children under 18 going to a Broadway show, that should bode well for the musical theater applications at CCM, shouldn't it, Peter?
Well, the other thing, too, is I'm very glad they're going to Annie and Cinderella, because those are traditional Broadway musicals, and getting to like that style of show is an important value to me.
You know, it's again, Damian Bazzadona from Situation Interactive has been working with the New York City school system and the league to bring lots of students to Broadway shows that are from areas of the city that wouldn't traditionally be able to attend a Broadway show. And these types of things are not only wonderful for the students, but it's wonderful because it's a lifeline, a way to build the community for the future. And it's very exciting to see those type of things happen. But as you said, you know, on the flip side of it, you know, taking a family of four out to a Broadway show is a very expensive endeavor. And it's hard to in the realities of it, that folks who are working on Broadway, who are, you know, the creme de la creme of the business, need to make money. And, you know, it's a tough thing. So I don't pretend that I have a solution there, but it's a very interesting thing. So, all right, we've talked for about an hour. I wanted to see, is there anything else you guys wanted to add before we wrapped up?
Gee, there was, and now I can't think of it. All right, what good is that anyway?
Michael, anything?
I apologize.
Oh, sure.
Oh, I just wanted to apologize if anyone went to see My Fair Lady at the Walter Reed Theater on the 26th on my recommendation, because they changed their schedule after they printed it. And it turns out they showed it the day before on Christmas Day. But which was also, it was originally supposed to be 2 days, and then they changed it. And I guess we're all supposed to know that somehow by like going back and checking. I don't know. So I wasn't too happy about that.
What did they show?
Gaslight. A very similar film.
Sure.
Oh, well. Okay, well, let me wrap it up then. I guess we should let you know that if you go to BroadwayRadio.com, you could find links to some of the things that we've talked about today, as well as a nice video from A Christmas Story from Madison Square Garden that's there, and links to all the different things that we've talked about, plus a list of the things that Peter and Michael had picked for the best of 2013. You can also find contact information for Michael, Peter, or me at BroadwayRadio.com. And there's also a subscribe button. That way, if you would like to subscribe to these podcasts in iTunes, it'll be downloaded automatically every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway. And Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m., and that's about it. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Just bye, everybody. When I start opening doors, finally knowing the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual flair, sure of my
Don't you love?